From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Jeff Schmidt, in for Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today, a conversation with two Iowans who made their mark in professional football. We begin the program with a conversation with Cedar Rapids native Bill Quinby. For 17 years, Quinby worked as a side judge in the National Football League. He'll talk about how instant replay has changed the way the game is officiated. Later, University of Iowa alumnus Tim Dwight, who last week was inducted into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame. Tim Dwight spent 10 seasons in the NFL. Iowans and their experiences in pro football next on The Exchange, right after news from NPR. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jeff Schmidt, in for Ben Kiefer. Today, we focus on two Iowans and their experiences in professional football. Later in the hour, a conversation with University of Iowa alumnus Tim Dwight, who spent 10 seasons as a wide receiver and kickoff and punt returner in the National Football League. Last Friday, Tim Dwight was inducted into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame for his track and football achievements at Iowa City High School. But this half hour, my conversation with former NFL official Bill Quinby. From 1978 through 1994, the Cedar Rapids native was a side judge in professional football. He worked a number of league championship games and was the side judge for Super Bowl XIX between the San Francisco 49ers and Miami Dolphins. Following his days on the field, Bill Quinby worked as a supervisor of league officials. He officiated during the infant stages of instant replay, where officials could use cameras to determine if a call on the field was made correctly. He says he sees the modern game changing with more reliance by referees using technology to get the right call. And he says it's apparent that today's officials face greater scrutiny than 20 years ago.
Oh, sure, I notice it. But I think we have much better television coverage. In my day, we had television every game, not as many national games as we do, but we did have television. A period of time in my day, we did not have replay. Then there was 5 years of my 17 years when I was on the field that we did have replay, but it was in a very small type of an experimental stage, but it was used. But now replay is such a big part of the game, and where there are certain times of the game that a coach can ask for a replay, he could lose a timeout. We didn't have that then. We just had a person in the replay booth, they called it. He was probably in the press box, and he was a former official. This is in my day. Mm-hmm. And he was watching the TV monitor and not had all. Nowadays, they have probably 6 to 8 different shots of every play right in front of the replay official.
Has it been a benefit when you look at the big picture? Do you think it's helped officials, or is it causing them to second guess themselves somewhat when they know that that big eye in the sky is...
Well, no, I don't think it has hurt them at all. When it first came in, I'm sure we, because I was part of the group then, at times felt that the replay was putting pressure on us. But after you learned that you were correct more than the replay ever made you negative, then you kind of gathered some confidence that, yes, the replay's here to help us. And they will correct a major situation. I know I probably was overturned in that 5 years twice on sideline catches where you got to get both toes in, tippy-toe catches. Those are difficult calls, and then also know that the ball's possessed all the way. And I was wrong, but yes, sure, my feelings were probably hurt for one day, and we also got downgraded if we made an error, even though replay corrected it. But I had numerous calls where they were really tight, and the replay showed, yes, you're correct.
What kind of communication was there between the officials and the league office between games? And how would you look about the games as a way of assessing your job?
Well, see, every game, Jeff, is observed by a live person up in the press box at that game site. He turns in a complete report of what happens on every play, where there's a foul, where there looks like there could be controversy, where there's a replay decision, and so forth. Also, the replay official turns in a play-by-play of what he saw on replay where he didn't go down to the field or where he did. And then there is also then the home team sends in a video to the league office that shows the end zone and the press box sideline of every play, right? So they can see what's happening. They can follow the script of the play-by-play sheet. And then the officials also, when they leave the game, they leave the locker room, they're taking those tapes with them. Every one of them have a tape. When they can get on the airport and turn their little computers on now, we didn't have that. We didn't have computers that way. They can watch themselves on a little screen and go right to the play, run it slow back, forth, and see how well did I do.
So a number of levels of scrutiny each week on how,
yes,
the officials
are scrutinized on every play. And then that's how they get in the playoffs. And the number one official that year with the scores of all 16 games during the regular season plus the playoff, if they get one, that's how they're going to get in the Super Bowl.
And I want to get into that as well, because you did eventually go on and officiate a Super Bowl. But I wanted to touch on another more modern-day occurrence in the NFL. The league has directed the officiating crews to focus on helmet-to-helmet hits this year, or what the league deems vicious hits to the upper body. We know, you know as well, too, concussions have always been a part of the violent game of football. Is it possible for the league office to try and change the culture of what they feel the NFL's becoming, the hits, the vicious hits, and to try and cut back on the concussions? Have you noticed this in your observances with
them? Well, I can only speak for myself. I am sure the league now, after many severe head injuries over the years, not just this year, have listened to the medical people that study brain injuries, and then going back and doing it. The league has done a lot of research of players that have played back 30 years ago, maybe 40, have had head injuries, and where are they today? I mean, are they suffering? Are they having trauma? Are they maybe having memory problems and stuff like that? And in my day, the head and the upper body, the shoulders, was pretty much legal contact. Well, definitely was. They had some very severe injuries. The biggest player then is Jack Tatum. I played at Ohio State, and then he was probably the meanest, toughest defensive back in the National Football League over the years.
Involved in the hit that paralyzed Daryl Stingley with the New England
Patriots.
Yes, and
sadly, that player was paralyzed all his life and then died fairly young. Yes, Jack Tatum, that's the way he played the game. But there were a lot of players that played the game that way. And when I first started in the National Football League in college, we didn't even have a spearing, like a player is running or he's going down and a player hits him with his helmet in the rib cage or hits him late with his helmet head. Well, about halfway through my officiating, spearing was a big issue, and then we called it. And once in a while, if a spear was very severe, you did take a player out of a game.
You were a side judge. What are the responsibilities of the side judge?
Well, a side judge was a downfield on the side. And in the NFL, when I went in, they went to seven officials. They were six. and they still had side judges, field judges. But so all my years, we had a referee, an umpire in the middle, head linesman, linesman on the line of scrimmage, a back judge, a side judge, and then a field judge down deep in the middle. And my responsibilities were, I started always at 17 yards from the line of scrimmage deep. When they snapped the ball, I usually took two or three steps backwards, just slowly, and then to see what developed. And I was responsible for the wide out of the line on my side of the field, whether it be a back coming out or a wide receiver. And most of the times it was the wide receiver, which we used to call burners, the guys that could really run, like sprinters and that. And that the only job they had is to go down and catch a ball, you know, outdo it. And then my calls were pass interference, holding on the receivers, or if they had offensive pass interference, and then the sideline catches, where you had to get in the pros 2 feet in, or what we call tippy toe catches, where it's unbelievable how they get them down and then possess the ball. And then we had the goal line a lot and touchdowns. Did he break the plane? Did his knee hit before he did? And that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Bill Quinby, Cedar Rapids native for more than 17 years on the field as an official in the National Football League. A big tactical change this year before the start of the 2010 season was the shift in location on the field of the umpire from the defensive side to behind the quarterback. At the beginning of the season, Peyton Manning of the Colts expressed some possible criticism, saying it could slow down the play, slow down some of these fast-paced teams, no-huddle offenses. Have you seen it make a difference from your...
I haven't, and I've talked to people that are connected with the league. I talk to my former supervisor every week, and no, it did at first, and Peyton Manning was correct. And the league certainly jumped on it. Hey, we got him. And they moved the umpire back on the offensive side of the line. One, they think he can see the holding better on his side. Now, the referee looks at the other side, but the referee is also, the white hat, is so responsible for that quarterback. Every move that he makes, even after he throws the ball, that referee keeps an eye. One of the big things, the league did a lot of research. They do a lot of research medically. The umpires are getting hurt so much. They really were. In my day, we had two or three fractured legs, rib injuries, not so many head injuries, but we had facial cuts. Or once in a while, a passer would throw a bullet right over the line. It would hit the referee right in the face.
Well, your days on the field were ended. Was that
because
of an injury?
I was kind of dumb. I was always a good volunteer. And our umpire got hurt in a game, a preseason game in 94. And so I went in as umpire the last quarter up at Green Bay. They were playing and I didn't do the right thing on mechanics. Like a pass play, umpire moves up the line and turns while I move back a step. And the quarterback, Ty Dittmer, was a backup to Brett Favre then. He came right down the middle at me. Well, the linebacker, I was in the way, and he just lifted me and I ended up with 5 ribs broken, a punctured lung, and I knew I hit the ground pretty hard, yes.
Talk a little bit about the rapport or communication on the field between you and the players and some of the players in your day that stand out for you.
Well, that was kind of the fun part of the game. There was communication, not a lot of butting us, but they respected you, and they knew how far they could go, and we did have an unwritten rule that if a player, coach, a doctor, sideline personnel would say something pretty nasty, you would say back to them, "I didn't hear what you said. Would you repeat it?" And they knew right away I've said something very vicious or the wrong word and that. But no, players were fun. I'll tell you the team that was always the most fun, the Oakland Raiders back in Alzado's day, Howie Long, they had Matt Millen. They had a line that was, and they always tried to intimidate the other team the first quarter. And then we'd always have, and then finally we'd get in there and about say, okay, now you've had the first quarter, you've had your mouthing and your talking. And Walter Payton was one of the neatest communicator. One thing he did before every game, but we kind of, it became a superstitious type of act. Before the game, we had to be on the field an hour before the game and check the sideline, you know. And if Walter didn't pinch you in the bottom, I mean, on the bottom, and say, sweetness wishes you a good game, you felt you were left out.
Were there some coaches that were more vocal than others?
Oh, yes, yes. Some had a language you couldn't bring home. I'll tell you, the finest coach, in my opinion, in my days, was Tom Landry. He was a gentleman, a Christian, never said a word on the sideline to the officiating crew. See, we always had to go in a locker room, two of us and the visitors, two different officials, to get the team captains, give them the official time before. And Landry is one of those that greeted you very politely, very well-dressed. Coaches were great. Mike Dickett was fun. Oh, he could chew you big time. And but after the game, the game's over. Bill Walsh was very good. Shula was a brilliant.
You bring up Bill Walsh and Don Shula. They faced off in Super Bowl 19 that you were part of. Mm-hmm. Talk about that Super Bowl. And was it? Did you feel like it was a different game going into it, or did you just try and treat it as any other normal game?
Well, I think I did before the game. But once it started, no, it was the same, you know. I always thought I should have had another Super Bowl or two. I didn't grade out. I did work five championship games, and some of those games were a little more hyped than the Super Bowl that I did work. We worked the Giants, San Francisco. When Montana got hurt, the Giants won and went on and won. Cleveland won where the player fumbled going in the end zone.
Ernest Biner?
Biner. I was on the goal line, saw the ball come out. I thought, oh, my golly, is this happening? And Denver fell on. That was a championship game.
We talked about favorite players. A lot of stadiums have changed through the years. Talk about some of your favorite stadiums that you enjoyed working in.
Well, my favorite was the one that I really liked and nobody would believe was the old Cleveland Browns Stadium. And sometimes it was very cold, but the field was the worst field almost. I mean, the baseball, Cleveland Indians played there in the summer and the Browns. But there was so much history there, Jeff. I mean, I remember we had to cut across home plate, which they never took home plate out, but they did take the pitcher's mound out and level off. That was part of the football field. And I can remember the first year I was there or two, I stood at home plate and I said, and this was an hour before the game, and I had my officiating. We're going over to see the visiting coach. I said, Babe Ruth stood here. Lou Gehrig, Bob Feller pitched out there. Lou Boudreau, shortstop. But the batters, you know, I mean, these were great ball players. And so I always enjoyed that. And the dog pond people, the end zone, oh, they were the characters. And Ruff and the dog biscuits would come flying out. And I do not think I ever officiated there, even on the bitter cold days, that it wasn't sold out.
Many people think, maybe unknowingly, this isn't a full-time position, an NFL referee. Some have been held under scrutiny for thinking that the NFL position should be a full-time, the NFL official should be a full-time job.
No, NFL, the baseball people, I believe the hockey and the NBA basketball are all full-time. But they work a lot more games, they earn a lot more money. A beginning official in the NFL now gets about $3,000-$4,000, beginner. If you're a 20-year man, you are earning a little over $8,000 a game, per game, plus all your expenses and hotels, first-class airfare and that. So they treat you pretty well. And then there's a pension plan and a severance plan and all.
What did you do for your other position during your NFL referee
days? I was a teacher, became an elementary principal. I was assistant principal at Washington High School. Then I went into personnel work, and I worked for an advertising agency, and I ended up retiring from Coe College as director of career counseling and athletic director.
When you look back, Bill, at all of your years on the field, what do you miss most about it?
Oh, the friendship of the other officials, and we still stay in touch, not all of them, but a few. There's quite a fraternity, especially the NFL. The NFL became unionized. They have an executive director, and he keeps everybody in touch through email, who's sick, whose wife is sick, and everybody keeps an eye on each other a little bit. I miss that, but I always missed. I was only an average official. I was the luckiest guy in the world. I really was. And I thank Forrest Evashevsky. See, when he was here, I got hurt, so I ended up being manager. And so I used to blow the whistle at practice a lot, a scrimmage and all that. And then Evie says, I'll help you get started, and he did. And that's how I got in the Big Ten.
So the former University of Iowa coach was instrumental in your career?
Yes. He and Bump Elliott helped. Bump went on to Michigan. And Gus Schrader, a sports writer and Gazette, helped me a lot, too, in the Big Ten. But, no, I don't miss going to games anymore. I know I'm not mentally or physically able to do those things. But every now and then I always think, wouldn't it be fun to go one more game, one more big one? And one of the things, Jeff, I always was proud of, because I was just average. I wasn't an all-star official and a Hall of Famer. But every play, I used to sit back there and say, come my way. Throw the big play, the big pass, it's going to be a tippy-toe catch or one that we got a is it a touchdown or not? And I'll make the call. And I always felt that way. And then you came home and you just hope that you were right.
You're very modest, but you must have been doing something right to stick around pro football for that many years.
Well, I'm not modest. I'm just honest. Mm. And yes, there are a lot of fellows that go into the pros and only last, I'm talking officials, 2 to 4 years. They always give more than 1 year, unless they were just terrible or got into some real troubles. And see, you're scrutinizing the NFL by security year-round. I mean, if a person has alcohol problems, drunk driving, or indictment with his company, you're gone. They usually say you're suspended until your trial and whatever happens will agree. But no, I was fortunate, and it's been good to me. We have a wonderful pension, and I'm proud of it, and still have a memorabilia and a lot of film. I got a lot of video games that my wife taped or they taped and clips. And so there's memories of what you used to look like, Bill. That's me. I was a little thinner, and or you can move a lot better, and that type of thing.
Excellent. Bill Quimby, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Former NFL official Bill Quimby from Cedar Rapids, who for 17 seasons worked as a side judge in the NFL. Coming up next, University of Iowa alumnus Tim Dwight, who spent 10 seasons in the NFL. Welcome back to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jeff Schmidt, in for Ben Kiefer. Today, a conversation with two Iowans whose careers were spent in professional football. Earlier, I spoke with Bill Quimby, a Cedar Rapids native who, for more than 3 decades, was a college and pro football official. This half hour, my discussion with Tim Dwight. Dwight was an All-America selection as a track athlete at Iowa City High School. He played football at the University of Iowa under Hayden Fry and went on to a 10-year career in the NFL as a wide receiver and punt and kickoff returner. He is probably best known for his 94-yard kickoff return for a touchdown for the Atlanta Falcons in Super Bowl XXXIII. He retired in 2007. Since then, Tim has established the Tim Dwight Foundation to help underprivileged children to secure education scholarships and provide assistance to the Children's Hospital of Iowa. He is also the owner of iPower, a solar energy company based in California. Tim was in Iowa last week watching the Hawkeyes battle Ohio State, and last Friday, he was inducted into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame. I spoke with him last week and began by asking Tim what he missed most about his days on the gridiron.
I miss the competition, for one. Going out there every day and just competing on a regular basis against other individuals is a lot of fun. You're playing a kid's game. You don't really have a whole lot of responsibility outside your job. It pretty much consumes your life as once you get to the NFL and also even in college. It takes a lot of time. And, I miss the guys. I work from home and pretty much on satellite a lot. So I don't have a whole lot of contact with especially people that kind of have the same, I wouldn't say motivations, but same experiences, so to speak. So you do miss the guys a little bit because, you all are driven somewhat by the same nature of playing that game and just enjoy, messing around in the locker room and just having a good time and just meeting new people and then playing in front of fans. And so, yeah, so I think that, missing guys and being competitive, I'm taking up triathlons now to try to fill that void in my life of being somewhat active. And I tell you, it's been a good learning experience. I feel like I'm a rookie all over again when it comes to triathlons and getting involved in some of these races.
Do you still follow the pro game at all?
I do. I follow the guys that I play with. I follow Breeze, Brady. I follow San Diego a little bit since I played there for a number of years. Atlanta, I still have a little piece of my heart for Atlanta, and I see that they're playing pretty well. I still follow the game. Not as much as I used to when I first got retired, but a little bit. I mean, it's good to still see. I'm still young enough for some of the guys that I play with or against that are still in the league. I enjoy watching them play and seeing what they do and being successful, especially for Drew, because Breeze came in as a rookie in San Diego in 01, and knowing him at Purdue, I didn't play against him, but knowing him in the Big Ten and being at Purdue and then seeing his potential, what could happen if a team really believed in him and he had the right type of offense around him, what he could accomplish. And it's neat to see him grow up into that stature and be named among some of the NFL's best and as a quarterback. And it's just been exciting to watch him grow. And it's neat to still watch the game and still watch guys that are still doing it. Yeah.
And obviously you keep an eye on Iowa City and the Hawkeyes.
Absolutely. But I've seen a lot of games. I went to the Arizona game, Penn State game, Iowa State game. I even went to Ball State game and now Ohio State. So I've done my tour pretty much this whole year, and it's been a lot of fun. It's been neat watching these kids go out and compete.
How did your time in Iowa City, under Coach Hayden Fry, prepare you for a career in the NFL?
Well, Hayden was always talking about being accountable and being dependable and working hard, and that's one thing I think that a lot of Iowa guys had instilled in them when they went through the program was that. Hard work's going to get you a lot of places, and that's the one thing that's kind of been always in my back of my mind and always kind of been my part of my arsenal is that, outworking somebody. And Hayden used to work us pretty hard. I mean, he always wanted to be coachable, and that's the other aspect. Hard work and being coachable is so important in the NFL because you can learn so much every single day on what you're doing. I mean, even though you might have ran this route, you could maybe run it differently if you had this type of coverage or if you felt like, this type of stem was better than this type of stuff. So there's always ways that you're tweaking your game to make it better. And I think that's, a lot of jobs are like that. But I think with Hayden, being coachable and having that work ethic is so important because if you're coachable and you can keep learning as you develop over the game, you're only going to get better. And obviously if you've got that hard work in there, then learning and putting that hard work together is always going to be a positive benefit to you on the field.
Tim, I'd like to get your take on a couple items that always seem to be grabbing the headlines associated with the pro and college game. Let's start with the NFL. The league office this year making a concerted effort to cut down on helmet-to-helmet hits. Unfortunately, concussions, as you well know, have always been part of the game. From your recollections in your career, is it possible for the NFL commissioner to try and change the culture and control some of that hitting that is part of the violent game of football?
I think so. I think it's possible to a somewhat a degree. I mean, obviously, it's a physical sport. I mean, that's part of the game is when you're on defense or offense, you're blocking it to take the individual across from you and hit them as hard as you can. So I think them bringing in and making more of an emphasis, we're starting to see, you know, they're doing a lot of more studies now, and a lot of players have coming forward and starting to demand on more studies being taken into account of head injuries and how that affects the player down the road, you know, 20, 30 years from now. And that's one thing I'm physically pretty good when I came out of league, but that's one thing that's always in the back of my mind is what's my brain going to be like when I'm 60, 65. But the other part is, you know, that's part of the game. That's part of the sacrifice that you make it going out on the field is, you know, that it's physical. You know that whatever happens on the field could either, one, put you in permanent disability, two, could kill you, and three, you know, create some problems for you down the road. So there is that knowledge out there that you know this game's going to beat your body up, regardless of your brain or your hamstrings or your bones. You're going to take some pounding. But I think it's also, at the same time, there's got to be a mutual respect and a responsibility of not just the organizations and the NFL in general, but as guys on the field. You know, you're not out there to kill, you're not out there to hurt somebody or take somebody out of the game all the time, or you're out there to play football and use your helmet as a weapon, things and of that nature is definitely not for the game. And me being an offensive guy, you know, we're usually the ones that are taking the biggest brunt, but some of those defensive guys do too, because they're getting blocked and they're trying to tackle a guy. Meanwhile, they got another guy that's on their team coming and tackling them too. So they do take some of the punishment, but you know, some of the hits that you saw before these new rules came out, they were pretty big hits. I mean, you don't teach some of those type of hits in football, and there definitely needed to be some type of just changing of the rules, and then also some penalties or also some fines to be upgraded to this, because you know the fans don't want the best players out of the game. You take all your best players out of the game, you're not going to have NFL football. You just have a bunch of ragged-tag guys running around out there not doing their job like they could if you had your professionals out there. So you definitely have to have a responsibility of keeping guys healthy on the field, because that's when you're going to get your best football. That's when fans are going to want to pay their tickets and then they keep coming to see the real product on the field. And that's what the NFL obviously is wanting to do, is they want to keep extending this league. They want to keep extending the life of the NFL, and they want to keep it making more profitable and making better ways to do business and making fans become more intrigued with the game. So it's important to have the safety involved there as well, because safety is going to keep guys on the field and it's going to keep fans happy. It's going to keep games even more and more competitive if everybody's out there. So I like the league. You know, the other question is not only just penalizing, you know, players if they're doing things against the rules, but possibly why don't we change some of the dynamic of the helmet? Why can't the helmet become more softer so then guys aren't using it as much as a weapon? You know, and I mean, Joe Paterno, I remember he was talking about, well, they take the face mask off the helmet. I don't think that's ever going to get to the point, but maybe they can somehow develop a new type of helmet that's a softer helmet. So when you hit somebody, it's not like you're hitting pure plastic on pure plastic.
On the college front, every year at this time, the crescendo starts. Who's number one? Who's number two? And shouldn't the entire argument be settled with a college football playoff system? Is there a better solution to how we get to a Division I champ right now?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I was a grunt. I was a player. I've never put together a round robin tournament in a bracket, let alone trying to figure this out. So,
right.
You know, I think college football's hard. It's a physical game. Nobody wants these kids playing 15, 16, 17 games. You know, maybe it's down to you take the top four teams and you let them play. And maybe that's the answer. But I don't know if a playoff system's ever going to materialize. I think that's going to be too long of a season for kids. Then you talk about the revenues, how those revenues shared between all the other teams and all the other conferences that they come from. So, and then you got, you know, now you have these championship games for each conference too as well. So you might have a team that's, you know, 12-0, and then they have to go into a conference game against, you know, another conference opponent in the championship game that might be, you know, 10-2 or 9-3, and they end up getting beat because it's, you know, it's a team that they maybe could beat, but since it's a conference game, it's an extra game, maybe they do get beat and they get knocked off and they never make that playoff round, even though they were, you know, they were 12-0 in that conference. So this, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that happen that are in, and I know basketball has their tournament and all the other sports and college football seem like they have their tournaments and things, but football I think is a different nature. And I just, man, maybe it's just a four-game playoff system. Maybe that's the easiest, where there's only two extra games instead of three or four games. But, I mean, I will have to leave that up to the professionals to figure that out. I just played, and you know, I just enjoy watching now.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Tim DeWight, former football player at the University of Iowa. Tim went on to a 10-year career in the National Football League. Last week, he was inducted into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame. You excelled in high school and college and on the professional level. I'm curious, from an athletic standpoint, was it a bigger jump for you going from City High to competing at the University of Iowa, or from heading to Big Ten play onto a career in the National Football League?
Definitely the latter. Going from a college program to a pro program is completely night and day. I mean, you've got different schedules. You're playing against guys that have played this level for 10 years, 5 years. You know, and then you're obviously playing against guys that haven't been as, or has been as long as you have, which, you know, when you go in, you're a rookie. So it's a lot harder. The speed, the type of routes and defenses you're seeing in the games, and the fame and the money. There's just so many other attributes and so many other variables that work in. So when you're becoming a rookie, it's a lot of work. And that's why, you know, NFL guys only last 3.8 years. One, the game's physical. Two, there's a lot of other deterrents out there. You know, once you get money in your pocket and you get famous and you're on an NFL team, you're a rock star now, so everybody's pulling at you. So going to the game, not just the game alone, is the hardest thing to do, but then you have all this other off-the-field stuff that you have to deal with that you're not really prepared for. Yeah, I mean, when I was a rookie, I was playing with Terrence Mathis, Tony Martin, guys that played 9-10 years in the league. They knew everything about being a receiver. I didn't know anything. Hmm. And then you line up against Deion Sanders. You're like, how many receivers does this guy shut down? And how am I supposed to get open, right? So, and then you got a ball that you have stripes on it. Now it doesn't have stripes on it anymore, and the quarterback puts it anywhere he wants. And you're running, and then you got these linebackers that are running around, and they're running 4-4, 4-5. And you're like, man, I used to run past these guys all the time. Now I can barely get around them, you know. So it's physically, it's very demanding. You know? And obviously that gets into your mental aspect too, where I can't get open, or I can't get off this jam, or I'm not running the right defense. And then you got other guys jabbing at you. And then you watch yourself on film all the time, and people are laughing at you because you don't know what you're doing. You're running a huddle the wrong way. And it's just but it's a fun experience. And once you get through some of those tough times, it's definitely worth the while. But I would say making the transition from college football to the NFL is by far the biggest adjustment.
At this taping, you are on the verge of induction into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame that will honor you. What memories do you still hold as your time as an Iowa City High Little Hawk?
Man, lots of them. I can remember the game against Bettendorf, against Tavian my junior year. I can remember all the playoff games. My senior year, win state championship up there at the Dome, coming off that field that night 17 years ago to this date. Wow, I can't believe that's been that fast, that long ago. No, just all the players I play with, my great offensive line, Zach Kubinski being one of the quarterbacks, Robbie Tyne being on the team, Brian Mitchell played baseball at Iowa, he was on the team. You know, just a lot of guys that you can remember. But it means a lot. You know, you grow up as an Iowa kid, and you want to do great things, and you just want to compete, and you have great teammates, and, you know, you go off and you win a state championship, and, you know, you really don't know what all that means when you're young, because life is still young, and you're moving around, and everything's new to you, and you keep moving forward, and it's nice when you come back, and you can see what you accomplished, and see who you accomplished it with. I had a good friend of mine ask me if I was in town this weekend, and he's one of my offensive linemen, and he was saying, hey, congratulations. I'm like, listen, you know, a lot of that had to do with you as well. I mean, you were in the trenches blocking for me. And he was a friend of mine that I'd known since sixth grade. And he was always telling me, like, you know, you're going to grow up and you're going to do something great someday. You're going to grow up and you're really going to keep moving forward and you're going to play in the NFL. And so he was always just reinforcing me that I was going to do something. And I told him last night, I was like, you know, thank you so much for always being that friend that always believed in me and always gave me the opportunity to do something. And
before I let you go, I want to touch on some things you've been involved with since the playing days. You've been quite active since the football days have ended. Let's start with the Tim Dwight Foundation. What's your focus with the foundation?
Well, I want to put kids in school. I want to get kids educated. You know, Iowa is known for our education, and I want to keep that moving. I know there's a lot of kids out there that have some financial challenges, and we try to do as much as we can to keep those challenges to a minimum. Also, the foundation donates to the Children's Hospital of Iowa. We've really focused in on the cancer center over there with these young men and women, these young children that have to fight this stuff every single day. You know, I go over there all the time, and it's just amazing just to see their smiles and their enthusiasm and their energy, what's going on when they're basically over there fighting for their life. And, you know, they've never drove in a car. They've never been to prom. They might not ever have these opportunities that we all have every day. And, that's what kind of keeps my camp moving and my foundation moving is you're just giving back and getting and seeing where I've come from and what I've been given and trying to replicate that and to give back to people that are definitely in need of it because there's nothing more rewarding than that. It's just going out there working hard every day and then knowing you're doing something good for somebody else. So that's kind of my focus is put kids in school, whether it's Iowa State, or you and I, and also donate as much money as we can to find a cure for cancer and to help these young ones have a better life and have some hope.
Earlier this year, you addressed Iowa lawmakers to promote renewable energy. What's your focus with your company, iPower?
My focus is to bring jobs to Iowa and bring this industry to Iowa. This industry is the fastest growing industry basically on the planet. And the United States will be the next growth market in this industry. And like we have done with wind, we need to do that just as solar. And the great thing about solar is everybody can be involved in it. It can be on any rooftop, minus some trees, obviously. But, it can bring economic development. It can bring job growth. It can bring more value back into Iowa. And not only can we then harvest corn and soybeans here, we can harvest kilowatt hours here. And that's kind of the main push for me is, you know, this isn't about the environment and about global warming. This is about job creation and investing in the biggest energy source in the universe. And creating value and creating opportunity for people to get back and to better their lives. And that's what I've been pushing, and that's what I'm going to keep pushing is, I mean, I work in California, Colorado, all over Hawaii, and some of my other clients are around the world. And it's just amazing what you can do for your client on an aspect where they can, you know, fix their costs and create better income streams for themselves, but you're also putting people back to work. And that's what we need in this country right now is we need new markets. We need to get into this energy plan. We need to revamp it all. We need to bring everybody into the game and start harvesting, you know, our energy and different resources because it is the biggest growth market out there. And we're in a prime spot for it. I mean, we've got a bunch of land. We got a bunch of hog confinements, a bunch of chicken farms. We got all kinds of places we can take solar power. And it's the next thing, and it will be the next thing for the next 20, 30 years.
One final question before I let you go. You've had a great high school, college, professional career. You've been venturing into a number of business opportunities. What other challenges are out there for you? What else do you want to accomplish?
Oh, well, I ran my first marathon, which wasn't too great, so I have to come back and run that one. I didn't break 4 hours. I haven't done my first Ironman triathlon yet. I did a half 2 weeks ago in Vegas. That got me warmed up for one that's coming up here in late June of next year in Idaho. So I think that's on my list. Knock down an Ironman, run under a four-hour marathon. Maybe settle down, have a wife and kids someday, and maybe get back into coaching down the road once my renewable company has pretty much slowed itself down and I can move myself away from that. But yeah, those are kind of the goals for me right now it's interesting, you know, you go through your whole life and you play sports, and then I was fortunate enough to play this game into my 30s, and I feel like I'm a 22-year-old kid, you know, getting out of college, trying to figure out, you know, exactly what I want to do, and now I do, but then there's also these other goals out there, like, you know, triathlons and maybe doing, these marathons, doing the qualifying for Boston, things like that. And then also hiking Kilimanjaro, I did that 2 years ago, and I want to go back, and I want to hike K2, I want to start doing some more. Real like hiking and descending on mountains and things. So there's a lot of things out there. And that's the thing about life is that, you know, you never know until you open up the paper and see something you might be interested in doing.
Tim, I appreciate your time. It was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Tim Dwight, who played football under Hayden Fry at the University of Iowa and went on to a 10-year career in the NFL. Last week, Tim Dwight was inducted into the Iowa High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame for his football and track accomplishments at Iowa City High.
And Ettinger now to punt it away, and this isn't much of a punt either. On one hop, Dwight. Still on his feet. Down at the five. Tim Dwight, the kid from Iowa City, comes up big.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange are available at iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jeff Schmidt. Thanks for listening.